From side hustles to success stories, this is the Finance Ghost plugged in with Capitec, where we explore what it really takes to build a business in South Africa. Rowan Boerter and Luisa Hutting are bringing Miso to Mzansi through the rollout of Market Cockerel franchise stores. This is their story. Welcome to this episode of the Finance Ghost plugged in with Capitec. We are deep in November at the time of recording, and by the time you hear this, it will probably already be December. So we are in silly season and people are busy. They are trying to finish things off before the end of the year. Speaking of finishing things off, my guests today have been out there in the wild building out their new store today, as they have been doing for the past few days and will probably still be doing for the next few years. Well, not that one store. If you're still building the same store in a few years' time, something has gone horribly wrong, but they'll certainly be building this business for a few years. I'm really looking forward to chatting to these two. I think it's going to be a huge amount of fun. So my guests today, Rowan Boerter and Luisa Hutton of Market Cockerel. We will discuss their exact involvement with the group later in the podcast, along with that wonderful name of Asian descent. Well, not Rowan and Luisa. You guys definitely are not of Asian descent. You are both firmly South African. Although at this stage, I'm actually starting to wonder if you might have honorary citizenship in Japan or Korea or wherever else, never mind South Africa, because you are doing so much work in this space to bring these cultures to South Africa. Welcome to the show. It's going to be a lot of fun.
Thank you so much for having us.
Yeah, it's great to be here.
So I think let's jump straight into the word cockerel, which is so interesting. And as you described it to me before we started recording this podcast, it effectively refers to the heart and the spirit. And hopefully I got that right. I think it's such a lovely term and it speaks directly to the way you're actually building this business. So the backstory, there's a lot for us to unpack here in terms of your relationship with Market Cockerel overseas and in South Africa, because it is an overseas brand that was then started here some years ago, and then you've been involved in developing it within the country and certainly in the Western Cape in particular, although you do have some business interests in it in Gauteng as well. Even your own podcast on some of this cultural type stuff, Ron, which we'll get to later. But let's start right at the beginning. That's enough of a tease of what's to come. You're a husband and wife team. You're both young entrepreneurs. How did you get here? What was the backstory of the travels and how this culture just grabbed you and inspired you to spend your day sweating it out, building out new stores?
Yeah, so I grew up in a small town in the Western Cape, and basically I was pre-internet, so the library was the only means of connecting to the outside world. And there was this one particular book that really stuck with me. It was a book on the Edo period or the Shogun period in Japan. And they had these beautiful illustrations of Japanese armor and just a completely different culture to anything that I've experienced up until that point. In South Africa, we knew China fairly well back then, but Japan was like a little bit of a mystery. And so from a young age, I've had my eye on Japan. Obviously, as a teenager, got introduced to Japanese pop culture, anime, and the like. So Japan has kind of been in the background for a big part of my life. And that's kind of how I managed to pull Luisa into the realm of Japan.
I, on the other hand, had zero interest in Japan. I had my eye more on Europe. But fast forward a couple of years from Ruan's teenage self watching anime, we ended up visiting Japan in 2016 just as a fun trip for 2 weeks. And when we came back, we were obsessed. We were like, we need more, more, please. And we just realized that it is such a culture with so much depth and so much to learn from. And fast forward another couple of years to 2018, and we found ourselves engaged, ready to get married, and looking for an exciting honeymoon adventure.
So we got an opportunity to go and work in Japan. A couple of months after getting married, we joke and we say we left on an extended honeymoon. And yeah, that's where for 3 years we lived in Japan and where we immersed ourselves in the food, the culture, the retail, obviously by extension. We kept on reminding ourselves, there's so much that we want to take back to South Africa. We didn't take this opportunity to live in Japan to escape South Africa. We are very much, as you mentioned at the start, very much South Africans. And the idea was just to have a little bit of a walkabout, as they would say, and go and experience a different country. But while we were there, we just wanted to come back and bring a lot of our experience that we enjoyed in Japan and bring that back to South Africa.
And of course, Japan, and especially the city where we lived, Miyazaki, was quite close to Korea. So we got to experience Korea a bit as well. And same thing, just the food got us. The food definitely got to us in Korea. And I think the retail and the experiences and the culture got to us in Japan.
Well done on rather choosing to bring back South Korea, because I think if you brought back learnings from North Korea, that would be quite problematic. I'm not sure we'd be doing this podcast, for example, at least not with my consent. No, I'm just kidding. So when you were working in Japan, was that like the classic teach English offshore kind of vibe, or what were you doing? It was that, right?
Yes, that's why we went over. And then I eventually started working as an operations specialist for a US-based company. So I was working remotely. And then that's also where Ruan got involved with JETRO.
Yeah, so we'll get into the consumer product licensing side of things. And in our preparation, I spoke about how Japan is like next level with that. But there I got a lot of experience working with a local municipality as well. And then from there got introduced to an organization called JETRO.
Okay, interesting. And I do want to take one step back before we get into some of that, because it really is just such a cool story. And how old were you guys when you met? Because it almost sounds like, Ruan, you kidnapped her to Japan the first time, or basically just force-fed her anime, and then eventually she was like, oh my gosh, if this guy is the one, I'm gonna have to just stomach this and get over it, you know, it's Dragon Ball Z or nothing.
That's exactly how it happened. He captured me when I was still a teenager. We met when I was 19 and Ruan was 20, the night of his birthday. Actually, we met and the rest is history. We've been together for 14 years now.
Amazing. Very cool story.
In my defense, I just mentioned Japan and Lou said, okay, let's go check it out. And then Asia did the rest.
Were you wearing Shogun armor and had one of those really big samurai swords when you mentioned Japan? And she said, oh, you know, let's go have a look. You know, still deciding, but I mean, she seems to have embraced it now, which is quite exciting. So whatever your tactics were, they clearly worked. So I think let's move on to understanding more about this JETRO thing that you mentioned, and then let's get into some of your background. So I think just walk us through what that is and how that shaped the rest of your journey.
Cool. So I am an attorney by profession, attorney of the South African High Court. But going into law, I knew that was not necessarily what I wanted to do with my life. I knew it was a means to an end, which sounds kind of rude, I guess. But for me, it was, I think a legal background is quite, it could be quite, unless you specialize, obviously, that's great. But as an introduction to everything in South Africa, it's quite broad and it touches on a lot of different subjects.
Look, it's the same reason that I studied accounting, so I completely get it, like 100%.
Yeah, it opens a lot of different doors, right? I think accounting is maybe even more useful because you get down to the nuts and bolts of a lot of things. With a legal background, you get to sample a bit of different companies, and they say like a clever person learns from their mistakes, but a wise man learns from other people's mistakes. And I think in the legal profession, you get to see a lot of mistakes made by different businesses or organizations, and taking the little lessons from there, I think has been very useful and helpful. But then after that, coming back from Japan, I got an opportunity to work for the Japanese External Trade Organization, which is a Japanese government-related organization that promotes trade from Japan to South Africa. So they identify various local South African partners who they then recommend to Japanese corporates or small businesses to kind of foster export-import relationships. And they're based out of Sandton in Johannesburg, so they work really hard to help SMEs in South Africa connect to Japan, and at the same time help Japanese companies connect with South Africa.
And that's JETRO, right? The Japanese External Trade Organization.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, got it. And then Luisa, your stuff is so interesting because as far as I know, you have this film and hospitality background, right? You worked in some startups there. You kind of mentioned it's such a diverse set of skills, which I guess is probably why this team works so well. But before we even talk about the combination of those skills, just your own background, what you bring to this thing, how that journey was shaped. It's so interesting to see how you got to where you are now. What have been some of the learnings and interesting nuggets along the way from that?
Yeah, I think hospitality and film sets you up for a really high-paced environment. If there's anything that puts you through the ringer, I think it is those two industries specifically. And it really teaches you about thinking on your feet, planning meticulously, executing on those plans to the T, and then just being really versatile. If you're hired on a set for holding a boom, you're probably going to do multiple other things like wipe sweat off actors' faces and also run around for their specific dietary requirements. So that's kind of where I started behind the camera. I studied acting, but then realized I'm too short, fat, and ugly to be an actress. So I had to go behind the scenes. And that's just really where I started to get interested in operations and what goes on behind the scenes. So I got really into the inner workings of what makes a business work, because I think that, you know, every set, every production is a small business in itself. You have your finances, you have your planning, you have your strategies. So that's where I started my journey into business. So I worked with small businesses, startups from there, with founders growing their businesses. And I think the main lesson, or kind of what I bring into the retail space, is I almost think that every day in a retail store is almost like a show or a performance or a film set. You know, you have before opening, before the curtain goes up, you have your prepping, your cleaning of the store, you're making sure that everything's on track and everyone's there, all the actors, aka your chefs and your cashiers, they're ready, they're prepped, they're hyped up for the day. And then, you know, when the doors open, that's when the curtain goes up and it's showtime. And you have to smile and wave, even if a customer comes in and, you know, they're a little bit upset about something or there's some challenges, you have to just keep the show going.
Yeah, there might not be applause all the time or standing ovation, but you've got to keep the energy. And also, inevitably, you can plan and rehearse as much as you can.
But someone's got to forget their words.
Along the lines, the light's going to fall out of the attic, or someone's going to slip and fall or forget their lines. And you just have to roll with those punches.
Yeah, and I think a big thing for me is keeping the team together, keeping that motivation going. When you're on set, the days are long and the months are long and they all roll into each other and it becomes really challenging to keep that energy up. And the same happens in retail. You have to keep those guys going and you have to really try your best to keep the smiles up and to keep the energy up and to keep the motivation there.
What Luisa taught me about all of that is that on a film, or especially in theater, I guess, you know, when it's your opening weekend, the energy is high, things are going well, and you're running on this adrenaline rush. But the first performance can't be different from the last performance. The people who paid the same price for the ticket goes to the closing performance, and that still has to deliver the same excitement to the audience that that opening show did. And that's, I think, exactly the same with retail, right? You need
to. Monday, Tuesday, and Saturday has to be the same quality of experience, especially since we're in experience retail and not just your standard.
So, Luisa, I won't comment on that self-deprecation there. And, you know, your chances of being an actress, you're lucky that we don't use the video or everyone would know you're lying, which I'm sure people would agree with. Certainly, Ruan would definitely. But what I will comment on is it's just such an interesting combination of skills, which is really cool. And I guess that starts to then tell us a little bit about how you split what you actually do in the business, what you each focus on. And that leads into the next thing I wanted to ask you, which is any tips you might have for these husband and wife teams out there, or romantic partners, obviously. Just before you answer that, one of the podcasts in this series was with Hugh Cunningham, and he's got a pharmacy, The Local Choice, a franchise that he runs with his wife, Yolandi. It was only Hugh on that particular podcast, but he had some really interesting advice there. So I'm keen to hear your advice and then compare what it's like versus his, for example. And anyone in that position, I think go and listen to the Hugh Cunningham podcast as well. You'll get two different perspectives, two very different generational views as well. They are quite a lot older than the two of you. So it's interesting to get their opinions versus yours. So hit us with the husband and wife pro tips for being in business together and thriving, not just in the business, but also in your relationship, because that is obviously very important.
I think communication, that's a boring answer, but communication is just so important. You know, you have to choose your lane as well and choose your kind of department, stick to that, but then also bring each other on the journey. So communicate with each other across departments, not silo yourself into just what you're busy with. Because if you're just both going to be on your own journey, you might end up in completely different places.
Yeah, I think that's a very good answer. Oh, I should think
that's our answer.
I should think it's a good answer.
Very diplomatic, Ruan. Very well done. I see no disagreement here.
But to echo what Lou mentioned, play to your strengths. I know that what Lou can do, I can't perform on that level. And hopefully there's a few things that Lou feels like, okay, let me rather leave that to Ruan to do. But like she mentioned, bringing each other on the journey, because, you know, the one hand needs to know what the other hand is also doing. And that sounds maybe a little bit obvious, but I think the benefit of starting a business or running a business with your life partner is there's no one you trust more. So it's easy to kind of just go like, listen, I know what Lou's doing is she's making decisions that's the best for us as a whole and for the business. But then, unfortunately, what then could happen is that at one point you might feel like a little bit out of the loop and then start doing double work instead of really dividing the tasks and
divide and conquer.
Divide and conquer, yeah. So I think that's very important. And at the end of the day, it's very difficult to, after a long day, come home and switch off and be husband and wife. But also at the same time, you've got the business that you're worried about and thinking about and that you need to problem solve. So I think it's also important to set aside time to be like, okay, no shop talk here. We just relax and chat about whatever we feel passionate about.
But also, that said, we love what we do so much. So yeah. It's really hard to leave it at the door and go, this is date night only. Because we're just so excited about the projects that we're doing and we want to talk about it. And it's what's going on in our lives at the moment. So I wish I could say that we're really strict about it and we have these rules, no shop talk at date night, but it's hard. And we've kind of decided not to be too hard on ourselves if that does spill over, because we just enjoy it and it lights us up and we enjoy riffing on each other and going like, yes, that's a good idea. Mm. Oh, you know, we should do this, we should do that. At the moment, it's what excites us. So we go with the flow.
Yeah, I think that's quite unique to our case specifically, because I think Lou and I are optimists and we both are dreamers. So I think that dreaming part and thinking about how we can improve or what new ventures or opportunities await, that also is what drew us together from the start, is that we share that passion and we infect each other with that excitement.
Look, you have to be an optimist. You absolutely have to be an optimist. It's such a cool thing to have brought up, because you have to be a dreamer. You have to be so bonkers to believe in what you're building. And we'll get to that shortly. But one of my favorite concepts, and people have said this to me before, it basically goes along the lines of, pessimists sound really clever. They can point out all the stuff that could go wrong, but optimists build the world around them and figure it out as they go. And somewhere in the middle is probably a sensible way to go through life. I guess that would be as a realist. I don't know. But if you're not more on the optimistic side of things, then you are definitely not going to build a business. So I think the fact that you guys share that is such a big part of it. You've got to both believe all the time. You just have to. Perseverance is the first moat in any business. If you stop believing, everyone stops believing. That's just how this game works.
I want to just quickly share a really cute story or something that happened today. So today was a big day for setting up the shelves in the shop. And that is really freaking complicated. Someone should make shelves that's not so complicated to set up. And we were like figuring this out and building the shelves. And one moment, Ruan was just really like over it. And he looked at me and he was like, honestly, they should really put something on the box or say like, this is not recommended to set up with anyone other than the person you're preparing to spend your life with. And I was like, that is so true. And also the same counts for setting up 4 shops in 1 year.
Yeah, 100%. You may as well go through it together, right? So let's talk about these shops. Let's talk about the business. You've given us some wonderful insights into who you are as people. Such an interesting couple, loads of passion. You've done a lot of cool stuff. You've traveled. It's amazing how often travel creates a lot of thinking around businesses. I always encourage people, if you can travel in your early life, you know, do it. You don't have to stay in fancy places. You just need to go and immerse yourself in cultures that are so different to yours. You'll learn a ton and you'll come back with ideas you never dreamed that you would have. And that idea for you guys, at least, is to be involved with Market Kokoro. So let's understand what that thing is, really. If I go onto the Market Kokoro website, it talks about being South Africa's online Asian grocery store. You talked about getting your hands very dirty today, fighting with shelving. So clearly it's an omni-channel model. And I think that talks to your specific involvement with this business in South Africa, because you didn't start Market Kokoro in South Africa. It's more that you've spotted an opportunity to build out a franchise footprint of these stores and to really work with the broader group in actually developing the business at the end of the day. In the Western Cape specifically, although you do have a store in Joburg as well, I actually saw in the press today that there's a nice deal with Pick n Pay now from a head office perspective at Market Kokoro. So very interesting stuff is happening there. So I think if you could just walk us through, firstly, Market Kokoro South Africa, which is not you guys specifically, and then the franchise strategy, the piece that you are building, and how you just got involved with this thing.
Basically, yeah, Market Kokoro Corporate was started by a Korean family in the late 80s, early 90s, I believe, and they grew to 5 or 6 corporate-owned shops and then identified franchising as a viable way of growing their footprint. And that's where we came in. We, through our professional network, knew the franchisor quite well and we've worked with them in different capacities. And then when this franchise opportunity presented, we said, you know what, let's give it a shot, because it's something that we feel passionate about. And the brand is such a vibrant brand that, again, we got excited about it. And I think so many other people get excited about Market Cook Raw. It's not just a stale offering. It's a surprising offering. Customers who visit us, they walk into a shop or a store and they're like, wow, you know, I want to come back here. They want to spend time there. And that's quite unique, right? Usually for South Africans, a retail experience is I'm in and I'm out. I hope the queue is not too long. Where's a cashier that's available? Can I pay for 20 items at the honey market without anyone complaining? Can I just get out? Where Market Cook Raw as a brand has created an environment that's way more experiential. Obviously, it's not just built on experience, but the experience part adds to what we do.
To add to that, that's what we brought to it. So the experience part and applying what we learned from our travels into how to change it from being a store to an experience and adding selfie opportunities, adding touch points for customers to do more in the shop than just buy a couple of groceries.
So our first store we opened a year ago, Market Cook Raw Linden. And the big thing that we introduced there is instant ramen cookers. So basically you can buy your instant ramen and then we've got these noodle cookers that you can prepare it and make it yourself. And that just blew up massively because it brings that experience to it. It's something in today's age, most consumers, they've got a gateway to the world through their phones. They might never have been to Asia. They might never set foot in Asia. But at least they can see what's going on in Asia. And if they see something cool going on there, they want to experience it. Now, not many people are going to get on a plane and fly to Korea or Japan to go and cook instant noodles. So I think it's a unique opportunity for us to bring that little bit of Asia to South Africa. So we opened the store in Linden in August 2024, and then Seapoint 2024 December. And then we've got a store in Worcester, and now we're building the Western Cape flagship in Bellville. And the franchise, there's a different franchisee in Durban, and then there's about 7 or so corporate-owned stores in Gauteng. I think the focus for us in this whole experience, as you mentioned, it's omnichannel. You know, you can buy a lot of the things online, but because there's such a big experience part tied to it as well, people still do want to experience the in-store experience. And that, at the end of the day, is also something very important to us. Obviously, Asian food is popping off tremendously over the last couple of years. I think if you go back 10 years and you try to sell miso to someone, they'd be like, what the hell is miso? But now the consumer is a little bit more educated. But at the same time, we've got to meet the consumer where they are. And that's also why our footprint is so important. It's blowing up, but it's still very much a niche, I would say. And also people still have the perception that if they buy Asian ingredients, they've got to cook Asian food. Whereas there's a lot of Asian ingredients you can easily incorporate into your South African cooking and just add that little kick. Not necessarily spicy, but just put it on another level. I think a low-hanging fruit example is Kewpie mayonnaise versus a regular mayonnaise. If you've tried Kewpie or sushi mayonnaise,
you'll never go back.
That'll be very difficult to go back to regular mayonnaise.
As a sushi fan, I've got to say that makes absolute sense.
Yeah. So I think the thing in Japan and Korea as well, they've got a big convenience store culture where they meet the consumer where the consumers are. Now, even though we're not on a convenience store level, we need to think, okay, where can we position ourselves that's easily accessible to different consumer bases, so to speak? And then, yeah, working with Pick and Pay and working with head office, I think Market Cook Raw as a brand is firmly behind the idea that a rising tide raises all ships. And that's something that also resonates deeply with me and Lou, because we want to, like we said, we are optimists and we want to believe that, you know, a blue ocean strategy can be applied to the benefits of multiple stakeholders. So that's kind of the approach that we have. We've got the corporate-owned stores. We've got the number of franchises that we run. And because we're a new franchise, it's exciting dynamic between tried and tested knowledge and a lot of product knowledge and experience. And then
unknown waters.
Yeah. And then the unknown waters, but also a fresh energy and the experience of living in Japan and in Asia for a bit, that we can also bring back and say, hey, how about we present it in this way that can make it interesting and maybe more accessible to local consumers? Because also, just to end that off real quick, the majority of our consumers are South African. We're not targeting the Asian community in South Africa. We are very much backed by South African consumers that love our brand and that support us on a daily basis.
I had a look at the Google reviews, by the way, for your Seapoint store, and it certainly suggests that people are very stoked to go and buy their noodles, cook them on site. So if you've got one of these stores near you, if you live in Joburg or Cape Town or even Worcester, I was mildly surprised to learn that. Pretty exciting for the humble town of Worcester. But go and check the stuff out. Go give it a try. It does sound pretty good. It's also quite a rapid expansion. So I guess my business brain immediately wonders, is this something that the two of you are doing full time? Are you having to side hustle to actually make it work? Or is it able to support you at the moment? Because obviously that's one of the big challenges for entrepreneurs, especially in the early stages.
So we both are consultants in our own capacity. I still consult with businesses, small businesses, founders growing their businesses, mostly based in the UK. And I spend 80% of my time on my consulting and only 20% on Market Kokoro. But that 20% doesn't include the weekends and the after work 6 to 10 p.m.
Yeah, I was going to say there's no ways it's 20%. It's impossible. I refuse to believe it. Rowan, what's your split? Your real split? This is like that David Beckham meme from Netflix where he pokes his head in at Posh Spice and, you know, just says to like, be honest, Victoria, be honest. So give us the real number here, Rowan, not this 20% nonsense.
I think, yeah, I spend the majority of my time. So I, as you mentioned, I also consult. My consulting portfolio is much smaller, so I don't have to spend as much time, fortunately. I would say I'm the opposite of Lou. I spend about 80% of my time on Market Kokoro and maybe 20% consulting. But yeah, I think, you know, these are our babies. So we need to nurse them and give them the attention they are due. But I think also that's where, not to just shamelessly plug Capitec, but that's also where they've been very supportive in their offering and being able to work with them. And then the business obviously expanding very rapidly. But at the same time, I do also want to give a shout out to our customers and our loyal clients that pull up to our opening events and stay the course in supporting us.
Yeah, absolutely. So I don't know if you guys have read Shoe Dog, the story of Nike. If you haven't, then you should. Ah, you're both nodding, so you have read it. So what I love most about it, because I hate the whole quote-unquote success porn movement. It's like, oh, I'm here on a yacht and I worked 3 hours today and now I'm unbelievably wealthy and you can do it too. Just buy my course. Just, it's the absolute worst. Anyone who has built anything of actual substance knows this is a lie. And I honestly recommend if you are starting a business, then lock in other sources of income if you can. If it's a bit of consulting, it really helps. You're dreaming if you think you're going to start a business, work 8 to 5 and pay your salary month one guaranteed. Unless you have very low overheads, that is a huge risk. So I would not recommend doing that. I mean, I am 5 years deep in my business. I can tell you I'm still doing 80 hour weeks. It's no better than my investment banking days, to be honest. It's probably at least as bad. It just is what it is. The weekends mesh into weekdays and evenings, and it is simply just a tough thing. And it gets much harder when you have kids and you have to really try and then make time for everything. And kids are the ultimate startup. They definitely take a lot more than 20% of your time, that much I can tell you. But I think the way the two of you are doing it is great, which is to build out this thing and then make sure that you can actually allow the business to stand on its feet without having to necessarily rely on it too soon, because too many businesses die that way. And that brings me back to Shoe Dog, because Phil Knight, who started Nike, continued to work as an accountant, I think it was, for quite some time, while he was literally selling shoes out the back of his car. That part of the story is amazing for me, and it's true. And the one thing I love about that book is he's just so honest, where he says that if he hadn't done it that way around, it would probably have failed. So in America today, that startup culture is very much around raising money, doing it with someone else's money, writing some cool blogs about failure and success. We don't have that startup culture in South Africa. It just doesn't exist. You're probably going to have to bootstrap. If you're lucky, a bank like Capitec, and they are very good with this, will support what you're doing. They might give you some of the finance to roll this thing out. But generally speaking, it's quite hard to get that in South Africa. So you've got to hustle and you've got to give yourself some runway.
100%. Just to echo what you were saying earlier, right? We kind of, especially with social media, right? We get quite enamored or blindsided by the overnight success that's been 10 years in the making. It just looks nice. Oh, start your own business and then you can work 3 hours and just chill. But friends of ours mentioned that as soon as you start your own business, you switch your 9 to 6 or 9 to 5 or whatever it is to a 24/7. It's just continuous.
The plus side, of course, is that you get control over your time. So I will say, if anyone's listening to this and going, oh my goodness, I'm not going to start a business now. You know, what is amazing is the amount of control you do actually have over your time. It is a big win. You're choosing when you work as opposed to someone else choosing for you, which for me at least makes a really big difference. Not everyone cares about it as much as I do. And that's why not everyone should be an entrepreneur. I genuinely don't believe entrepreneurship can be taught. It's not for everyone. I think you can learn some underlying skills that you can apply to a business. And the two of you have proof of that. Fulman Hospitality meets Legal. But bring those skills together, and if you define those skills properly and broadly enough, then you understand how they actually relate to a business and what you really learned along the way, which I think is just fantastic. So something I wanted to ask you, given that you've now got stores in both Cape Town and Joburg, what are some of the differences that you've observed between the two cities, other than the quality of the pavement outside and how often the grass gets cut, obviously, but what are some of the other differences in the retail environment for Cape Town versus Joburg?
It's quite a different consumer. We've kind of established or spoken about this quite a lot and realized that it's more the older consumer that's so different. And then the younger consumer, because they have access through their phone to similar things, they tend to kind of magnet towards the same kind of things. So some differences that we've noticed is that in Cape Town, you compete with not only other restaurants or other retail opportunities, but you compete with like tourist attractions, because a lot of our customers in Sea Point especially are tourists. So
yeah, I was about to joke and say you're competing with the ocean. And then I thought, no, maybe I shouldn't say that. But actually, it's right. You are. You're competing with the mountain and the penguins.
Yeah, 100%. There's a whole host of things that you can go and enjoy, experiences that you can go on that's on your doorstep. You know, why go to a retail store in Sea Point? You know, so you are not necessarily competing with other Asian grocery stores or small restaurants or anything. You're competing with, like you said, the ocean, the mountain.
Something that is also interesting between Joburg and Cape Town is that Joburg has a more captive audience. So they also don't mind to drive a little bit to get to your shop. Just like Cape Townians, they might drive to a wine farm over the weekend. Joburgers, they don't mind to drive 40, 50, maybe even an hour to a retail shop for that experience. So you have a more of a captive audience.
Yeah, this just blows the minds of Cape Townians. So I grew up in Joburg. I lived there for 27 years or whatever it was, and in Cape Town for the past decade. And it's just mind-blowing how different these cities are. And that is one of the single biggest differences. You're absolutely right. And I think it's because of the road network. You can get from one side of Joburg to the other in like 30 minutes. In Cape Town, you could barely get from Milnerton into the city in 30 minutes because there's an ocean and a mountain and not enough roads and too many people. So it really is a factor. It's actually a big, big factor.
In Joburg, it's almost like a build it and they will come. Whereas in Cape Town, it's you have to take it to the people. Mm-hmm. And that's especially what we realized with our Sea Point store. Someone from Durbanville does not want to drive all the way to Sea Point, especially not when there's a rugby game on at Greenpoint.
Vice versa. Half the people in Sea Point think that Durbanville is in KZN because they've never driven any further than Newlands. It's just it's just a fact about the city. It blows my mind, but these really are the facts, honestly.
Like you said, take Joburg. You've got people commuting from Pretoria to the city, to Joburg, on a daily basis. It's a 40-minute or an hour drive, you know. So an hour out of Cape Town, it's on the other side of the mountain. So yeah, I think the other thing where Cape Town is quite different to Joburg is that there's quite a significant tourist contingent to Cape Town as opposed to Joburg. I think you've got a lot more digital nomads living in Cape Town than you do in Joburg. So someone coming from a New York or a Los Angeles or a London where you've been exposed to Asian products for a lot longer, they come and they live in South Africa or in Cape Town for 6 months or 3 months. They still want to buy those products. And that's kind of where they figure into your store as well. Where Joburg, you don't necessarily get... Listen, I think Joburg as a tourist destination has got a lot to offer or a lot to develop that they can offer. But the reality of the fact is people touch down, head to Kruger National or head to Cape Town from Oatambo. So we don't necessarily see a lot of tourist customers shopping in Joburg.
As a retail business, you just have to recognize this stuff. That's absolutely right. There's no point in beating around the bush with it. It's just the reality of the two cities. They are two different places. They attract very different clientele. And if you don't adapt from one to the other, it's almost guaranteed that you will fail. It was very interesting in this podcast season. I also got to speak to Ricky Ruthenberg. He's the co-founder and CEO of Bootlegger, obviously now a national brand in the coffee shop and restaurant space. They actually started in Sea Point and then eventually built out in the Western Cape and then went to Joburg. Then they had to deal with COVID, big disaster. They've gone back to Joburg subsequently. They've made it a success, big lessons learned along the way. And it's almost a different world, the two cities. He talks about how when they went to Joburg, they practically had to restart with the brand. They thought they'd go there and people would know it. And actually, everyone thought Bootlegger was a bottle store with the S on the end. So they've got to teach people. There's no S on the end. It's a coffee shop. It was a fascinating podcast episode. And if anyone listening to this is really enjoying this concept of these consumer-facing retail businesses, go and check out that Bootlegger podcast as well, because I think you will really enjoy it. Just one other thing around your regional focus. So I think you mentioned to me when we were chatting before this podcast that Westgrow has been quite a useful pillar of support for your ambitions down here in the Western Cape, which I found very interesting. Not super surprising, because I have had engagement with Westgrow years ago, I must be honest. And I'm keen to hear more details on that. What was your experience? Because other entrepreneurs listening to this might be keen to understand how Westgrow and similar organizations, if they can find them, might actually help them.
So as first-time business owners, we didn't know what to do or where to go to be legal and do what we need to do. Of course, the franchise offers some guidance and some things that we need to do. But Westgrow and the GGDA in Joburg, they were tremendously helpful in supporting us to provide us with what we needed to do, just guide us with all the compliance that we needed to have, all the certificates we needed to have. They've even helped us with advice on advertising and research, and they have a whole network of really kind and helpful people who have come across our path just because we connected with them and we reached out to them and asked them for help.
I think we were quite lucky. I met the Westgrow team through past endeavors, and same with the GGDA. We met them for a delegation we hosted in the past. But the crazy thing is these guys are a significant resource that you can use, not just a network that you can tap into, but they have good relations with the city of Cape Town, so they can get you answers to your questions real quick. They are very efficient and super helpful. They're just a bunch of really helpful, very friendly people.
They helped us to expedite a lot of the things that we needed. And it's free.
Yeah, that's the thing. The help that they provide is free. They might ask you a few things for their stats, you know, like how many people you employ and things like that, to kind of gauge the economic impact. But yeah, they've really helped to also just make us feel, it's going to sound weird, but to kind of feel that we are surrounded by people who care about us without having any stake in the business. They just really want to see us succeed as well and have made their resources available to us, which is, I think when you're starting a business, any help that you can get from a semi-government related organization is fantastic.
Absolutely. And it's their whole mandate, right, is to promote growth in Cape Town. I mean, my engagement with them was over 10 years ago. It was actually really interesting. I approached them because I was quite keen to potentially go work there. It was right near the end of my investment banking days. I was looking for something that was more based in Cape Town, and it just wasn't the right fit for everyone involved, but I was super impressed with the engagement with them. Solid people, and it's nice to hear stories like these. It really is very cool. So well done. And it just shows, I think the lesson is, if you reach out to people and you ask the question, the worst they can say is no. And the best that can happen is a whole lot of great stuff. So your upside versus your downside, that's a great trade. The finance geek in me would take that trade every day. And I do suggest business owners do the same. Just ask the question. You have got nothing to lose. Literally. So we've talked a bit about experiential retail and how you're building that out and how this thing is so different and you've gotten involved in it, which is great. How your skills have come together and the differences between these two big cities in South Africa, Cape Town and Joburg, and your experiences there. It's been fascinating. And there is one other big trend underneath all this, which we haven't gotten to yet. And it's a nice place to start to bring this podcast home, because this is the concept of consumer product licensing. It's something they do so well in Asia. And this Korean movement, this K-wave, as I've seen it described, it's a big thing. So it's K-pop Demon Hunters, it's Squid Game. That was kind of the start of it for a lot of Western consumers. Netflix started bringing this Korean show to the world, and then they did K-pop Demon Hunters, and everything just exploded. It became memes, all this stuff. It's just gone from strength to strength. There's a lot of other stuff as well. There's tons of Japanese IP that people are familiar with for decades now. Loads of anime, Pokemon, Dragon Ball Z, etc. It's a whole different world. People do enjoy that culture and everything it means. So what do you think the opportunity is in South Africa to then expose consumers to this? What can we learn from this consumer product licensing culture that they've built in Asia, this behemoth of an industry where you'll see products that sometimes make no sense to Western eyes? Stuff like Crocs with all the funny little things on them. Those are massive in Asia. And here it's like, ooh, Crocs. It's a bit weird that people wear them. Sorry if I'm offending anyone, but you know, they are Crocs. The number one way to not be offended about wearing your Crocs is to not wear your Crocs. Just kidding. Let me stop there. Let me let you talk about consumer product licensing and what you think that could actually look like in South Africa.
I'll leave that to Rowan because he's the expert.
And by expert, you mean geek. I know that you mean geek here.
That's where everything starts, right? I think the interesting thing about consumer product licensing is it's a win-win situation, right? If you do your homework on what brands could resonate well with your target consumer, you get to introduce or sell your product using someone else's IP, right? So internationally known, let's take Pokemon or K-pop Demon Hunters. Everyone knows that. I've got a manufacturing plant manufacturing t-shirts in South Africa. I license that IP. I put it on my t-shirt or I design some clothes and then I sell it to a consumer. So I get to leverage that global brand in a South African context. And that resonates quite strongly with me as supporting local manufacturing. So how do you differentiate your white t-shirt from someone else's white t-shirt imported from wherever? That could be a really strong differentiation point. The thing that I think Asia does really well when it comes to consumer product licensing is that they recognize that the human experience is vast and diverse, and people interact with a variety of products and things on a daily basis, right? And if I'm a fan of a specific IP, I might want to buy that croc gibbet or whatever it's called, right? I want to have the opportunity to buy that at the end of the day.
Look at this guy pretending that he's not quite sure what it's called. You know, oh, whatever it's called. Meanwhile, back at the ranch, this man has a wall of crocs and gibbets and K-pop demon hunters and little market kokoro things that he puts on them. Come now, be honest. I'm going to quote all David Beckham back in here again.
Yeah, so the thing is, but at the same time, they also know that even though I'm wearing crocs and those gibbets, I want to go out to eat somewhere. So why not then have some noodles with the brand on? Because that's a way that they're going to get my attention and I'm going to buy that brand of noodles. Also just to be part of the craze, you know, for a bit. But if I'm a fan, you know, that'll be something. And the product is good, of course, that's vital. I'll return to it. I think in the South African context, what's been challenging for businesses, and that's kind of where I find myself spending, you know, that 20% of my time that I'm spending not at Market Corporal, I'm spending on trying to develop the resources that businesses can use to make a better decision when it comes to and better understanding the anime consumer or the pop culture consumer in South Africa. The demand is there. If you go to Comic-Con Africa or Comic-Con Cape Town, your mind will be blown. Your eyes will open to the vibrant communities that support these different IPs that are asking for these products. But the industry has been quite unorganized for the longest time. You have someone doing something, you have someone else doing something else. You know, Simba brought out the Tazos back in the 2000s or whatever with Dragon Ball Z and Pokemon.
Yeah, I remember that. That was, wow, that was a whack of nostalgia across their head.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Thank you. Yes, no, absolutely. Thank you.
You're going to go dig through your flip file to see if you find any of them.
I think my Tazos are long dead, but I certainly had them. I absolutely did have them.
Yeah, but the thing is, and this is where the Blue Ocean side of things come into play as well. No information was ever shared necessarily on how well that promotion did for PepsiCo or Simba or whoever brought it in. But as we go deeper and deeper into the information age, those resources become available. But even though you need to go and dig for them a little bit. But I had an interview with Burger King for Comic-Con Africa earlier this year, and they did a promotion with Naruto. And the whole executive marketing team said, no way, Naruto, do South Africans watch anime? I've got no idea what this thing is. Let's be conservative. They ordered 300,000 units for a month-long promotion. So that's 300,000 toys, essentially. They sold out within the first 2 weeks of that promotion. In their whole team, there were only two people that said, listen, I'll resign if you don't bring this promotion to South Africa. So, you know, that information is vital to prove a point to Burger King to say, okay, listen, we need to bring something similar next year. But then if you look at the box office in South Africa, everyone thinks, oh, cinemas are struggling. It's a dying industry. Then we've got a release of Demon Slayer Infinity Castle, which globally was a massive phenomenon. From my understanding, the local distributor thought they're not going to do too well. The movie grossed $9 million at the South African box office, $9 million, I believe. That's the highest grossing movie in South Africa. It outgrossed Superman. It outgrossed Fantastic Four, quite big names. So I think, you know, that shows that there's a focus on these Asian brands and they've got like a lot of marketing power behind them. So why not use those brands to promote your products and promote your offering? I think that is, it's like you said earlier, it's kind of a no-brainer, right? If there's some information that backs it up, it's really worthwhile to try and explore that.
And the stuff is big. I mean, the one thing that I found so interesting is when that AI model came out that was copying that Studio Ghibli style animation, people were furious. They were not just slightly angry. I think a lot of creatives have obviously been jolted by AI And a lot of creative people are quite into a lot of this anime type stuff and that style of Eastern storytelling, I suppose. But wow, people were angry about that Studio Ghibli thing. Frankly, as they should be, it really is beyond me why so much investment in AI is about going after art as opposed to actually genuinely making people more efficient. But that's a discussion for an entirely separate podcast, which we certainly won't get distracted by now. So, Ruan, there's obviously a lot of passion for this stuff. Luisa, you've been kind of dragged along into it, but I think there's some passion there as well for it, which is very cool. And I think that's great. And the lesson in there is how important it is to be passionate about the thing you're building, because you are going to throw so much time and energy and everything else at it. So I've got a couple more questions. We don't have much time left at all. This has been a nice, long and juicy podcast. First one, you did mention Capitec earlier, but let's just chat a little bit more about that. I think you've used them for franchise financing and a few other services, and to just help you grow the business. Been a bit of a lifeline, right? I'm not sure you would have been able to do it without them.
Absolutely. And they've been incredibly helpful. Honestly, we're not just saying this, but they have really been so helpful. And we moved over to them quite recently, actually, but they've really been helpful in setting up our
accounts,
setting up our
POS system.
Yes. And you take over.
I think the key thing from Capitec's side is obviously they've got a very strong focus, especially Capitec Business. They've got a strong focus on the SME sector. And I think it's no secret that the small, medium, micro enterprise industry in a country plays a big role in the backbone of that country. If it's strong and vibrant, the country is all the better for it. You know, it creates a lot of opportunities.
I think philosophically, we really align
with Capitec. Which is maybe a la-di-da answer. But at the same time, on a practical level, as bankers, they don't feel like people sitting in an ivory tower locked away that you've got to phone a call center. I think their target is to answer a call within like 5 seconds
or 30 seconds.
It's insane. And it's just because they are so consumer focused. And for a business where we need to be consumer focused, where we need to focus on going to the customer and giving them what they want when they want it,
That's exactly what they've done for us.
It's refreshing to have a bank provide that service to us, helping us. You know, like I don't have time to sit on a phone call waiting for hours to chat to someone to give me an answer. So they feel part of the team as opposed to just this grudge that I've got to go deal with someone at the nearest branch or whatever.
So I think that's exactly why they resonate with entrepreneurs, because they do obsess over their customers, honestly. The fact that they made this podcast possible really shows it. And honestly, every single guest I've asked on this podcast series gives roughly the same answer, which kind of goes like this. I'm on a Capitec podcast, so, you know, I know it sounds like I'm going to say something that I kind of have to say right now, but it actually comes across so sincerely from every single one of them. Everyone says, you know, Capitec's been a great partner. And so it really is lovely to hear that. Ruan, last question, and I'm aiming this at you because as far as I know, it's only you doing this. Although if Luisa was in the background of these podcasts, she should tell me. But such is your passion for a lot of these cultural elements and this content that you also do have your own podcast. What is it all about? Where can people find it? And perhaps most importantly, do you wear Crocs while you are recording it? That is a very important additional question.
He definitely wears Crocs while doing it.
Oh no, is it? Oh, I hope there's no video then. I'm hoping it's just audio.
No, luckily it's just static imagery.
There we go.
Listen, I won't be much of a fan if I didn't wear the Crocs. I need to drink the Kool-Aid. Lou has been a tremendous support because, you know, sometimes it's like, what are you doing? Yeah, the podcast is called the Not Just Anime Podcast. It started this year with 8 episodes available. Half of the season is consumer focused, and then the second half is more business focused. And the idea is just to illuminate Japanese and Asian pop culture in South Africa and to kind of provide people and potentially other businesses with some insights in how the fandom works, but also how the business side of things work when it comes to consumer product licensing and the pop culture content. And Lou's background in film has helped me actually quite tremendously, because a podcast is hard, man. The Finance Ghost is wild. What you've achieved is very impressive, and a ton of respect for doing what you're doing.
Yeah, that's very kind. Look, it is my business, and that's the difference. I think for you, it's adjacent to your business, but it's also a passion project. So I actually almost have more respect for that, because you've got to find the time in and amongst everything else, whereas my podcasting literally pays the bills. So in some respects, it's easier. My motivation is not just that I enjoy it, but also because I need to pay school fees. Whereas on your side, it is a bit different. Although I do really, really love what I do. I'm very lucky in that regard. Ruan, Luisa, this has been such a fun chat. Thank you so much. I would certainly encourage listeners to go and check out Market Kokoro online. Got to tell you, I'm pretty keen to go and have some noodles, either in Durbanville at this new store, maybe in Sea Point, Or maybe you should just come open one in Milnerton and then it's nice and close to me at home. We can consult on locations because I've lived in the area for about 10 years now. That would be quite fun. But thank you so much for your time. Thank you to Capitec for making this podcast possible. And if you've got a craving for some Asian culture, and especially Japanese, Korean, maybe some stuff you've never experienced before, go and check it out. Expand your horizons and your taste buds, because that is what being alive is all about at the end of the day. Ruan, Luisa, thank you so much for your time. It really has been lovely having you on the show.
Thank you so much. This has been so much fun.
Thank you. Thank you. It was an awesome conversation. Thank you so much.
Real stories and real people. Yours could be next. Plugged in with Capitec. Capitec is an authorized financial services provider, FSP 46669.